Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and a different guest discuss the 1973 cult horror classic The Wicker Man, one section at a time. I am joined in this week's episode by Howard Kasner. Howard, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's a nice Wednesday. It's Wednesday, isn't it? It's a nice Wednesday morning in Los Angeles.
Yeah, nice Wednesday morning, and, well, nice Wednesday a few days after May Day at time of recording, so...
Yes. Oh, that's... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a good time to do the recording then.
I think so, yes. Well, this is a May Day movie in more ways than one. It's also a movie where you go, May Day, May Day.
Okay, so yeah, so in this section of the film, following from previous one, we see how we buy in on the discussion the residents of Summer Isle are having, making point to note that Alder McGregor, the pub landlord, is having to continuously let out his costume as Mr. Punch, which becomes important later on. And then it basically starts with a bit of admin about what's the actual route of the parade's going to be, and that actually going to be a sacrifice. And of how he's seen that, he then goes back to Mae Morrison's post office and makes his attempt to search the entirety of Summer Isle as the time he has before the parade starts, with the scene ending after how he has done part of his search and has returned to his room at the Green Man pub. So, how, before we start talking about this section of the film, why don't you tell us your history with The Wicker Man and your thoughts in general on it?
Well, I first saw it in college in the 70s. I didn't see it when it came out of the movie theater. When I was in college, both during the week, but especially on the weekend, various societies would be showing movies to raise money for whatever club or cause or whatever it was. And certain movies were shown over and over again. Certain anti-establishment type movies were extremely popular. And The Wicker Man was a very, very popular one because of the way it deals with Christianity and celebrates paganism at a time when the hippie movement was cresting, or had just crested, but still the remnants were there. Even though by the time the movie ends, we see that paganism isn't necessarily all that great or any better than Christianity. But it was one of more popular films. I've seen it a couple of times since then. Did you want to know my general opinion of the film?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's a movie that is fun to watch because it's so bad. I think it's a terrible film. I think it's pure camp and kitsch, which makes it very enjoyable to watch for me. Not everybody feels that way. And in college, when people would watch it, they would all sort of laugh, but not at, sort of laugh with or celebrate all this paganism. And when the kids or the girls would say penis, everybody in the audience would think, oh, that's great. Well, I'm just rolling my eyes. I'm just saying, oh, God, is this the best you can do if you're going to try to shock people? It's a movie that tried to be shocking, and for a lot of people it was. And I'm just saying, nice try. It's just not, but I'm very hard to shock. I have the same reaction to The Devils, where everybody thinks, oh, this is a really shocking movie. And I'm just rolling my eyes and saying, oh, is this the best you can do in trying to shock people, because it's not particularly shocking. So that's basically, I think, the best part about it is the music and the lead actor, Ed Woodward, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he in many ways holds the movie together. He's really, really very good, but nobody else there is quite in his league. The story itself, it's very problematic. It really depends on someone doing a lot of things that no one could ever predict someone would do. And I've always wanted to know how they knew he was a virgin. That's always been one of my big questions. I suppose if they did enough research, they might find out that he was a virgin. But I'm not sure. I don't remember clearly. Did he ever state at the very beginning that he actually is a virgin? He's just a devout Christian.
Yeah. Well, the last thing, it's not actually in, well, this version that we're covering in this podcast, or the theatrical cut, but actually in the director's cut, as mentioned back on the first episode, there was a prologue set on the Scottish mainland where it's kind of an open secret that Howie is a virgin, and he's admitted that he's a virgin.
Oh, okay.
Saving himself till marriage.
Right. Well, that makes a lot more sense, because I'm going, okay, most Christians aren't virgins, even if they're single. So even at that time, you know, but he's the 40 to 50 year old virgin.
This would have made a pretty different film if it was Edward Woodward instead of Steve Carell in that one.
Yes.
So yeah, it's actually kind of interesting because this is probably the first time on this podcast I've had someone that's been a bit more lukewarm on the film as a whole. And so, well, this is the reason why I like doing these podcasts, get these differences in opinion. And yeah, I do understand where you're coming from because, yeah, I definitely see that there is some elements of 70s camp. There's definitely some bits that's kind of seen as comedic.
Yeah, they just hit you over the head with this paganism, so it doesn't really feel real. Whenever the young people talk about sex, they don't sound like real people. It sounds like manufactured dialogue. And it just feels like he's trying to be naughty. You know, oh, Tony Schafer and Robin Hardy are being naughty, and that's about all it is. It's a naughty film, but it's not particularly a shocking or challenging one itself.
Yeah, it's from what you take it with this one. Again, I can... Again, as much as I love the film, I can understand people having those kinds of reactions to it. And yeah, I do kind of get the feeling that, yeah, it feels a bit like it's trying to be scandalous on just...
Right.
But for me, I've viewing it as how much of it is in character for the film and they're just deliberately wanting to shock Howie, or how much of it is they're just trying to get a bit of a rise out of...
And they did. It's just that it's very hard to shock me or get a rise out of me. One, when I was on a show about the Devils, I said, the Devils isn't shocking to me. It's just so in your face, and no filmmaker ever seems to be able to know how to film an orgy and make it believable or make it interesting or make it erotic. And when Hitchcock in The Lady Vantages shows a nun in high heels, that's shocking to me for some reason. In Rebecca, when Mrs. Danvers talks about the underwear was made by the nuns at this particular... That's shocking. I don't know why that's shocking. But this is what you do when you're a teenager trying to shock adults. And most adults, they do get a rise out of them, or they get mad and then they just look at each other and roll their eyes and say, oh, kids being kids.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a matter of tone, really. Like stuff like Rebecca or Lady Vanishes. It feels like they're having a more serious, somber, like noirish tone. So stuff like those elements stand out more because there's nothing really like that at the time. And then right. Also considering the time of those ones, you know, stuff like the Hays Code and like the morality issues and seeing stuff that they were getting away with at that time, it's stuff that can feel more shocking. Like I remember when we did the pop art episode of a few years ago, when we talked about the Virgin March, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
And stuff that, there's parts of that film that are, considering that was the 30s, that are pretty shocking in seeing what they were able to get away with. But you kind of see, like, in something like this, it's more, especially this makes of stuff like Clockwork Orange and knowing the history of what was happening.
It went under the Hays Code goes away and you get the rating system and anything goes, then everybody's trying to shock everybody and then nothing really becomes shocking.
Yeah, kind of like desensitizes.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just for me, I just find it kind of silly and I always did. But it did shock other people. I mean, people in the audience, yeah, they were saying, oh my God, did they do that? Oh my God, did they say that? And I'm going, okay. You know, and like the Devils and other things like that where they're going, oh my God. Can you believe they did that? And I'm going, yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, it's not that.
Yeah, I mean, this, and you know, I do feel a bit of that way with The Devils, because like, I do really like The Devils, but it is a very silly film. Like,
yeah.
The way that Ken Russell films The Devils, like the constant crash zooms, and especially like during the Rape of Christ scene, I just ended up laughing when I watched that for the first time because of how ridiculous it was presented.
Yeah, and so sometimes I feel that here. I think, though, one difference is The Wicker Man is far more entertaining to me than The Devils. Yeah. It's a lot more enjoyable. Some of it, the enjoyment is because it's, as I say, it's trying to be shocking when it's not. But it's, in some ways, it's a solid setup for a mystery. He gets this anonymous letter. He goes, everybody denies this person exists. He finds proof that the person exists. And that's an interesting mystery in and of itself. And you do want to find out what's going on. So the plot is more interesting than the devil itself. When instead of trying to deal with the actual issues that, for example, were in the book, The Devils of Ludon and the play, they just make it shocking and sort of ignore the more interesting theme of the previous examples of that story.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting then see comparing like The Wicker Man and the Devils, what they had on over like the genres. Like you see like all the types of folk horror mysteries getting influenced from The Wicker Man, whilst The Devils, you can probably guess that the feel of like the dunsploitation films and like those kinds of like softcore eroticism, is those kinds of stuff were influenced by The Devils.
Right, and here, yeah, you're right. They're very influenced by not just Hammer films, but there is a certain trope, and I talked about this in another episode of Pop Art, horror films, and I think it was in Village of the Damned. It might have been another one. In the U.S., when they were making these horror films and these sci-fi films, the evil always came from outside. You know, they were these monster animals or aliens from outer space.
So like kind of and playing on Cold War paranoia.
Right. In the Hammer horror films, it was people going to small villages and finding out there's witches and devils and satanic worship. And the evil was coming from within the people itself. And I always thought that was a very interesting difference in American films, horror films, and British horror films, where the evil originated. And this is one example that you can see influenced by Hammer horror films. But as the writer and director said, what they didn't want is they wanted to have a more realistic pagan practice. So this is more closely related to actual pagan practices rather than in other horror films and Hammer horror films where you go and find this evil. As you know, you've seen Hot Fuzz.
Yeah.
And Hot Fuzz satirizes all sorts of films. And it does satirize this idea of going to this small town that seems very nice on the outside.
Yeah.
It is actually just evil underneath.
Yeah, and Edward Wood in the opposite role in Hot Fuzz.
Right, exactly. So,
and it's interesting thinking about the horror legacies at the time, because you know, at this time you've had stuff like Wicker Man, you've done stuff like Village of Damned a few years earlier, then stuff like Blood on Satan's Claw, Witchfinder General. It's almost these kind of like this initial cycle of folk horror, and as mentioned, as more focused on the evil within rather than the evil outside. That's the way that these kind of things can take root in society.
Yeah, even for Village of the Damned, where it comes from outside because it's beings from another planet that impregnated the woman, yet the evil comes from the local women giving birth to the evil. So it still is within that kind of area of sort of folk horror, but not quite. But you have others like The Witches with Joan Fontaine, of all people. Yeah. You know, you have one with David Niven and Deborah Carr that actually takes place in France, Eye of the Demon or Eye of the Devil or something like that. So, yeah, this is a very common English type of horror. They did folk horror for a long
time. And you definitely see like how like folk stories and folk tales and how they lend themselves to horror. And even like with characters that are showing in this section of the film, they become figures in folk horror in recent years. So, like towards the end of this section of the film, when Howie is seeing some of the other characters that the residents of Summer Isle are either dressing up as or they're like creating representations of, one of the characters that he sees is John Barleycorn, like the bakes making, which although John Barleycorn's traditionally associated with alcohol, but see. Well, I was thinking of like representing barley and wheat. Well, I don't know how familiar people outside the UK is, but have you heard of the TV series Inside Number 9?
What is it again? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's Inside Number 9. It's with created by written starring Reese Smith and Steve Pemberton. Also did like The League of Gentlemen with Mark Gatiss.
I don't think so. I've not seen that here. So not on BritBox. Or it doesn't come on Netflix, then.
So again, it's a really good anthology series. So if you're able to find it, then I'll check it out. But in the last series, like not the one that's ongoing at the time of recording, they did an episode called Mr. King, which was basically their homage to The Wicker Man. And in that story, the character that they were doing the sacrifices to was John Barleycorn. And it's kind of interesting seeing how you've got these cycles of folk horror and these characters that kind of build up top of each other and can influence each other throughout the years.
It's not really part of ours, but the ending also is quite problematic as well, in that they're going to sacrifice this guy, and he's a policeman. Well, when he doesn't come back to the shore, that island is going to be inundated with police. So I'm going, how are they going to hide the fact? They can't just say, well, he left. That's not, no one's going to buy that. So, you know, and it's at the end, you know, he's yelling, you know, next year when this doesn't work and the crops fail again, they're going to sacrifice you. You know, I'd sort of be yelling, you do know that the police are going to come looking for me. And you just murdered a police officer.
Yeah, I mean, the way I always viewed it was, I mean, they've still got Howie's seaplane, so it's not outside realm possibility that they can just fake a plane crash or mechanical issues.
They can try.
Yeah.
But, yeah, good luck with that. It's the same problem with Midsommar, that movie. All these kids from college go missing in one location. It's going to become an international incident. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of thinking of how far you're willing to spend disbelief with this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm willing only up to a point.
But yeah, I mean, then just going into this section of the film specifically, I mean, I do kind of like that we've got all this admin talk about here's the route we're going to take for the parade, here's how we're all going to be laid out, where we're going to do all the sacrifices, what's all going to be. To talk about the costumes and how they fit. I'm a sucker for these little details of admin in films.
Well,
you probably cut out, but it just tickles me.
Well, it's certainly, this is, starts out an interesting scene. The music is great. It does unfortunately show just how awful men's fashions were in the 1970s. I also used to dress like that, and it's just embarrassing to look at it now. But yeah, it is. And it is, once you've seen the film as a whole, you realize that this is basically, they're going to be waiting for the policeman, but for the officer at the beach.
Yeah.
So that's how that's going to work. So it's setting that up.
Yeah, and then also kind of linked to following on from the previous section, where you see Howie following the hobby horse. And it almost feels like they've deliberately waited until the hobby horse came back and there's a greater likelihood that Howie is there to watch and know what's happening so that he knows the route they're taking. And
right.
So they can kind of lead him into the trap.
It has an odd bit of editing when he talks to the one who's going to become the jester. And he walks away from the jester, and then it cuts. And then it cuts back to the jester where he lifts up this thing, this pole or whatever, under his arm. And I'm going, they must have needed to fill that in for some reason, because that doesn't really work. It doesn't add to anything. It doesn't add to the story. It doesn't actually add to the rhythm. So I think they just had to fill something in there. So they took that and put it in. That happens a lot in movies. Sometimes you'll see a person, and there was no reason to cut to that person, but they just had to have something there for continuity.
That bit of a bridge.
Yeah.
You can kind of see it as him getting into character as Mr. Punch, but yeah, it just feels like, you can see that it does go on that's that little bit too long. Yeah, and then we've got like the kind of way that they kind of view it into their traditions, like talking about what the specific sacrifices are going to be to the different gods. And we find out the nature of the sacrifices later on, but for me at least, it's kind of interesting how they've built up this these different elements of this is how this specific culture views the gods and how they their relationship to them. And it's these kind of things that help to me build up the world and from how the characters within it have created these ideas for themselves.
Well, I love all the masks, and I love the costumes when they're in, when they're getting ready. Not everybody's in costume yet, because it's all a preliminary, but people are sort of getting into the spirit of things. Those are some great masks.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine thing where when you've got a year in between these ceremonies, you definitely want to make sure you look your best.
Right. It's like Carnival at Rio.
Yeah. Yeah, just, and again, considering it's this coach that Holy Stave the Year, is, you want to put the effort in.
Right.
Yeah, and then, we've got to the bit in the, and how he returns to the post office. And I don't know if you know, I've never quite been able to get to see what Mae Morrison is actually cutting out. It looks like it's a cake of some sort.
It's but a baby.
Yeah. Maybe just because of poor baking skill, but yeah, it doesn't quite look right to me. Maybe it's just the actual bake itself.
Well, it's kind of weird to bake a baby and cut up a baby. I think it's supposed to be symbolic of sacrificing an innocent of some sort, but right. I'm not sure exactly what it is that the baby would symbolize. There is a very interesting line here when Ed Woodward says, what kind of mother are you? Your daughter's going to be sacrificed. And she says, you'll never understand the true meaning of sacrifice, which is very ironic because his whole religion, Christianity, is based on a sacrifice. So we get a little irony in there that he doesn't understand sacrifice, but they do.
No. Yeah, and also that bit of double meaning as well, because in that, what you're there intending for him to be the sacrifice, that he won't get properly understand why he's the sacrifice for them.
Right. Yeah, it's just funny that calling Christianity not understanding sacrifice, when that's what it's all about, and that's the whole basis of it, it brought it into animal and virgin sacrifice as well. So this has always been a fear of Christians that paganism will come back. And there's always this fear in the back of their minds that they're going to lose control. This is a power struggle between pagans and Christians in this. And Christianity put an end to most of these pagan practices or adopted them in to the way they worship. And even today, there's this fear in the U.S. especially, that non-Christianity beliefs are going to take over and we're going to go back in to pre-Christian times. There's this constant battle over that.
Yeah, again, as you said, a lot of pagan ideals and beliefs have been kind of absorbed into Christianity. I mean, just take Christmas, for example. That was...
Right.
It's actual origins as a whole, they're based in paganism rather than Christianity.
Exactly. So, and Easter has a lot of paganism in it as well. So there's, and in many ways, both Christmas and Easter has been taken over by paganism.
Over the years. I mean, you definitely kind of see that way he's different. And you can see other bits of media that have played in with that. I mean, I think most notably for me, Neil Gaiman's American Gods has really played around with the nature of worship and Easter and how Christianity and paganism, those different religions, can kind of coexist or be co-opted by each other.
Right.
As I've said throughout the podcast, a lot of the conflict of the film is a religious conflict between how is Christianity and the paganism of Summerisle. But... yeah, it's always interesting thinking about how we've seen the time, but and also how we view it through a modern lens and with the changes in attitudes towards different religions in the 50 years since the film was released.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's probably we still have New Age. That's the closest we have now to the hippies of the 70s, which were trying to get back to nature, and the closest we have now is New Age. And New Age is taken as seriously in many ways as paganism is. And we do have a lot of cults today as well. So paganism is still with us in many ways, both in good and bad ways, just like Christianity is there in both good and bad ways.
Yeah, it's something where it's more the person and how it's being presented rather than the religion itself.
Right.
And yeah, then we now get into how
I
we actually...
I was wondering, though, about this candy shop, because it's so huge. And I'm beginning to lose how big this village is. And I don't understand how this shop can sustain itself.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it is so big.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's actually not just the sweet shop. It's also the post office. And
still, there's so much candy there. I mean, and the next scene is when he goes, starts, I'm going to search every house. And he does it in a matter of a couple of hours. I'm going, how big can it be if he can search every house in a couple of hours and that can sustain this huge candy store? It's just usually what sustains villages like this is tourism, but there's no tourism here. And the last thing they would want is tourism.
I mean, this is an island that's economy is 100% reliant on agriculture.
Yes, on apples, which they had a bad crop this year. So, yes, but then he starts to search. And I do find this actually to be kind of funny because he thinks this girl is being hidden purposely, but he treats it like a game of hide and seek.
Yeah.
Oh, she's being hidden purposely. Oh, maybe she's behind a curtain. You know, maybe she's in the first place anybody would look if you're playing hide. And in one of the first houses he goes in, he opens this curtain. There's this stairway that goes down. And he doesn't go down it. The one place where she might actually be kept prisoner, he just ignores it. And he somehow manages to search the whole village, looking behind curtains and in cupboards and things like that, as well as this ship out at sea. And he's mainly looking in the places where they would never hide a body.
But again, this is all just the stuff that we're actually seeing, though. I mean, we're just seeing like the stuff. It feels like they're deliberately trolling him, like the puppet's having positioned in a way that looks like they're having sex. The like puppet in what looks like a coffin, or a chest, and the girl hiding in the wardrobe. That's
the best part of it. The girl hiding in the wardrobe and falls out. And I mean, oh my God, that girl just hits the floor face on. How do you do that in real life? But that's the best one, where he thinks he's found this body. He's just being teased.
Yeah, but and then also, that'd be a way interesting way to compare it with how this scene was presented in the remake. Because in the remake, it kind of goes a lot faster in that version. So, and the only like real one that's kept the same between different versions is the girl falling out of the wardrobe. All the other ones, it just feels like in the remake, Nicolas Cage's character just searches like one house and gives up. And that's it. Here in this one, at least you get the understanding that he's trying multiple places. He's like looking different houses, the ship, the butcher, the baker.
Right. I think it's a fun montage. I don't think it's a particularly well thought out one, because it's just, you know, every time he looks behind a curtain, I'm going, oh yeah, that's where they're going to hide a body, you know, from the police. Let's hide it behind it. So it just was a little odd to me. But it's kind of fun. And the music's great. And it has a nice energy.
Yeah. I mean, I've, again, for everyone listening, I'm a broken record at this point. But I've loved the music of Paul Giovanni and Magnet. And in this one, again, you can feel like the folk roots of it. Because it's basically just a version of Baa Baa Black Sheep. And like we hear like Baa Baa Black Sheep sung in this section. And it's a very unique way to score a scene like this. Like, again, comparing it to the remake, that one feels more generic mid-2000s. This score of that is like every other score you've heard in every other horror film at this time. Whereas here, there's not really been any type of music like the work Paul Giovanni did with this one.
No, it's a really good score. It's a wonderful score. It's one of the highlights and best things. And then he goes into this room with this naked woman in a bath. Why she's in a bath instead of a bathtub in a bathroom?
Well, again, this is a like sort of root of the times, the having a separate individual bath that you'd have to fill rather than having the bathroom. It feels like sort of a product of the specific infrastructure of Summer Isle.
Well, but it's the 1970s. They're at least going to have a shared bathroom somewhere. Yeah. She's not going, you know, that by this time they've gotten electricity, they've gotten indoor plumbing. But they want to have a nude scene. They want to have, and they can't do it with Britt Eklund because she's pregnant.
And they already had the seduction dance earlier on.
But that's not Britt Eklund.
Yeah.
That's a body double. So here they have this full frontal of this woman. But, you know, that was the times.
Yeah.
You want to get that in. So we'll just get this hip bath in and have her take a bath in it instead of in the bathroom. And then he doesn't search the room. And I'm going, well, maybe she's sitting in the room somewhere. And although,
to be honest, if you just walked in on a woman having a bathroom, would you just want to go and sit in the center of a wall? Do you just awkwardly back out and try and pretend you've not seen anything?
Well, yeah, you probably would. But I'm going, it just all adds up that this search doesn't really quite make sense. And it's not how a search would be done. It's actually today you would never be able to do a search like that because they would just say, no, you can't come in without a warrant. And that would be a stop to that because you just can't.
Yeah, I mean, at one point he literally does just break into a house.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the 70s. And I sort of bought that on this island, this guy might go around and doing that and they would just accept it. You know, today that's going to be much harder to get away with. As well, because it's just, you've got to have a warrant. He says this because he thinks the child is in danger. You need more than that.
Yeah.
But this is an island off the coast.
Well, he's the only authority figure aside from Summer Isle.
So I bought that he would do it and we'd get away with it. You know, that I didn't really have a problem with that.
And yeah, it's also an interesting thing. Think about the scene order in the original and the remake, because in this version it has Howie finding the seaplane is broken first and then doing the search, whereas in the remake it's the other way around. And I think in terms of order it makes more sense to me for Howie to do the search after the seaplane's broken, because at least in that point you see he's get the seaplane, goes back to the mainland, gets a full troop of Scottish police to the island, and then they do a proper forest search, right? And then when he's just doing this search here, when he's got no other choice to get it done in the time. Whereas in the remake, having it find the seaplane destroyed after he does the search, it feels like he's not really put in the remake, they've not really put any attention into what he would be a logical order for why he would do the search in the first place on his own.
Right. Chris is Nicolas Cage, and Nicolas Cage does tend to go crazy.
Even in that sort of version, it doesn't feel like... I mean, I love Nicolas Cage, but he doesn't have the same kind of indignation that Edward Woodward has. And I think that's one of the reasons what makes this section so first, because you can feel his growing anger and frustration come to the forefront as the scene goes on, but I never really got that with Cage's version of the character.
Well, I never saw the Cage's version because it got such horrendously awful reviews and considered one of the worst films of all time, so I never bothered.
Yeah, well, you're a better man than me. And you probably made a smarter decision. I absolutely hate the remake.
Most people do, so you're not alone.
Yeah.
I do like the scene in the where the coffins are in the funeral home or the craftsman shop, where he opens one and there's a body in it. And it looks like it's a real body with the coins on the head so she can...
The bribe for the ferryman.
Right. So I don't know if the paganism that time would have done that, because that's a Greek, Roman, and even Egyptian thing. You can take with you things that you're buried with. But I thought that was a nice scene where he opens it and I actually thought, oh, now he's finally looking someplace where they might actually hide a body, hide someone. But that was a nice little bit there.
Well, yeah, it also feels like this kind of branch of paganism, they feel like different roots for all different kinds of mythologies and folklore. Like when we see like the fishmonger, his costume was the salmon of knowledge,
salmon?
Which was,
yeah,
I forget, in Irish folklore.
Oh, okay, because I was wondering the salmon of knowledge. But, yeah, if it's part of folklore, that makes sense. They probably all these animals have some sort of connection. I mean, we have the dragon, which is very big in Ireland, you know, St. George and the dragon.
Or like or Wales, like the Welsh dragons, like the flag of Wales.
Yes. And I'm not quite sure what they're doing to the dragon there at the end. It looks interesting. They're doing something underneath the dragon. They're trying to do
it's some type of a gainer plane, but it's actually kind of interesting, like the way it's designed, because you've got the dragon thing, but also that's meant to be the hobby horse as well.
Oh, yeah.
But again, it's more just like how, in terms of how it's designed.
But that I like that when they were having this fun thing with the dragon. The dragon's sort of going after them, and they're doing something, throwing something under him, or trying to get his feet, or trying to hit something.
I mean, definitely see if later on when it actually goes into full procession. It's like that bit of the act this person does. It's has that play, being a bit more playful with the... With the people in the procession.
I mean, Ed Woodward is, in many ways, feels very shocked at all of this going on. And it's not, is it that unusual for people to have holidays like this in England, where they do bring out some pagan ideas and dress in costumes and things of that nature? It just seems like, what is going on here? And I'm going, well, it's May Day. What are you so surprised at? But maybe this was unusual for the time.
Yeah, I think it's more just his personal morals, so like the way they're doing it, and the religion they're doing it for. Because like you've got like the traditional English summer fetes, and you say like the ways that stuff like the Maypole or Morris dancing and stuff like that have kind of bled into wider British culture. But it's all like smaller parts of it. I think for Howie, seeing all of it combined into one key event where it's 100% clear, it's that there's no Christianity, it's 100% paganism, and that's kind of a moral offence to him.
Exactly.
And then again, there's also got, and again, the last bit of this bit is Howie returning to the pub, and like the way that it's like Willow greets him, and I'm going into the next one with Howie's. With how Alder McGregor treats him, the whole thing does feel like they're deliberately trolling him.
Oh, they are. Well, they need to keep him there, but they can't do it, obviously. They have to trick him into staying there. So they have to deny the girl exists. They have to deny all this while making him more angry and making him more
suspicious.
Willing to stay. Yeah. They have to act suspicious by acting like nothing's wrong at all.
Yeah. It's the whole thing of how far they go with it, because you know, some people are more like subtle about it, or they're more feel a bit more naturalistic. But then you get people like the Willow and Alder McGregor, and they're hamming it up. They're trying to act as suspicious as possible, especially as it gets later on, and it feels like, especially in this bit, they're doing it to rile him up as much as possible to get him frustrated, so that he'd be. more willing to actually try and infiltrate the procession.
And yes, then he returns back to the inn, the bar area, where Britt Eglin is, of course, filmed from the waist up, because she is pregnant.
So that's going to the end of this section of the film. So yeah, before we get on, Howard, is there any other thoughts you have on this section of the film, or just the film as a whole?
Actually, no, I think I've sort of covered it all. It's a fun little bit because of the montage and the music and him searching around for the girl. He's not able to really leave. I don't know what it would take to get a boat to go back to the mainland if he flew there. I don't know how far off the coast this island is.
So Aberdeen's like on the northeast edge of Scotland to Orkney, which is one of the like islands off the coast of Scotland. Using a modern day ferry, like a good few hours, but again, that's a modern day ferry. For Howie this time, it would just be pretty much just have a rowboat, or a sailboat, or if he's lucky, something with an outboard motor. And I mean, it's mentioned earlier in the previous section that it would take about a week for Howie to be rowed to and from Summer Isle.
Well, they do have to have pretty regular deliveries island from the coast, because everything is just a bit too modern. There's too much stuff there. I mean, they don't make their own liquor there. They don't make their own candy there.
Yeah.
They may grow a lot of their vegetables and milk and cattle and things like that, but this is a well-stocked island, so they have to have regular deliveries.
Yeah.
They do have that one ship, but it's sort of doesn't seem to be motorized. It seems more of a sailing frigate some sort.
But yeah, this is kind of thing where I can imagine like cargo ships taking deliveries to and from the island.
Right, yeah. So it'd be very difficult to get back. It's like 10 little Indians. They're out on this island in the middle of nowhere, and there's just no way. And they can actually see the coast from there, but there's just no way they can get back from it.
Yeah, so, is there any other thoughts you have on the film?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, then. So that's comes to an end of episode 30. Howard, I'd like to thank you for being on the podcast and ask if you have anything you want to plug.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a lot of fun. I really love doing these sorts of things. I do have my own podcast, and it's called Pop Art, where we find the art in pop culture and the pop culture and art, and you've been on it. You did Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, which was an answer on Lamberty, and I only know it because of you, and then I didn't ask it in the form of a question,
So
I didn't get the points. I was so mad at myself.
Oh.
I would combine that with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But the one up right now is with Derek Nguyen, a filmmaker who made this Vietnamese horror film called The Housemaid. We did Hair and No Regrets for Our Youth, two films about some young people protesting a war. Next will be Stephen J. Rubin. That's the one I'm working on now. We've recorded it. I'm editing it now. He's the author of such things as the James Bond Encyclopedia, where we're doing North by Northwest and Tell No One, two films about people who have been accused of a crime they didn't commit and are on the run. And then we have the 100th episode. I am reaching my 100th episode of Pop Art, and it will be with Donald McKinney, who was my very first guest and who helped me set up and get it going. And we're going to be doing the Flight of, I think it's the Flight of Dragons. It's not the Flight of the Dragons, but I think it's the Flight of Dragons and Dragon Slayer, two films about young people and dragons.
Yeah, good stuff. Then for me, you can find my main review site outside of this podcast over at cougsreviews.wordpress.com. Howard, I want to thank you again for agreeing to take part on this podcast.
Great. It was great. Thanks.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone listening. I'll speak to you again next time.